Several weeks ago, I was talking with my son and asked him, what percentage of the Earth's surface do you think is covered by water? In about 10 seconds, he picked up his iPhone, went to the Google search engine, or to use a verb not in the dictionary, he Googled it and told me 71%. I thought to myself, what would I have done to get that answer when I was my son's age in August 1988, or when I was just starting college 50 years ago this month? In August 1975. To get that answer in 10 seconds now would have 50 years ago taken me hours to find in an encyclopedia, a geography textbook, or an atlas at the nearest library, assuming the library was even open at that hour. This may be hard for many people my son's age and younger to comprehend, but Google and other companies like it have changed the world. Though I would not expect my guests to agree with this characterization, some say that Google is the most powerful company in the world, with one of the most recognizable brands in the world. We're honored at WBGO to have our guest today, Kent Walker, the President of Global Affairs and Chief Legal Officer of Google and its parent company, Alphabet. Kent and I are about the same age. We are both lawyers. We were at one point in our careers both assistant U.S. attorneys. But Kent is far more of a visionary than me, and in 2006, he joined Google as its general counsel. Today, he is one of the top executives at the company, and in my experience, one of the most engaging and approachable senior corporate executives I've ever met. When I asked him if he would be a guest on this radio show, he readily agreed. Kent, welcome to WBGO, and thanks for your time.
Jay, it's a real pleasure to be with you today. It's an exciting era and looking forward to our conversation.
I will note that this interview, this conversation, was pre-recorded on August 14th, 2005. So, Kent, Google is very big in our daily lives, so big that people like me encounter Google multiple times a day and probably don't even think about that. Could you share with us something about Google that many Americans may not know or fully appreciate, but you'd like them to know?
Sure. Picking up on your story about your son, I think it's astonishing right now that people around the world all have equal access to knowledge. A poor kid in the slums of New Delhi has the same access to information around the world as the President of the United States might have. That's unprecedented in world events. And the fact that we can serve so many people in so many different ways is really an honor for us. We are right now in the midst of this AI evolution. And people forget that they've been using AI for a dozen years. If they've been using Google Search or Maps or Translate or even Gmail and not getting spams, that's all been AI behind the curtain. And now we're in this new era where AI is stepping out from behind the curtain, a little bit in the spotlight. And the opening up of new opportunities for everyday work and for extraordinary changes to advancing the frontiers of science has never been greater.
That's interesting. So I'm particularly interested in Google search. When I go to Google and I ask the question about how much of the Earth's surface is covered by water, or researching for this interview, I look up Kent Walker. I see certain things, certain news sources, certain information sources in a certain order. Could you describe how that works?
Sure. So we've been working on search for 25 years, and it's evolved an awful lot in that time, including the inclusion of some of these new AI models. But fundamentally, search is anchored on three different principles. We want information to be accurate, we want information to be relevant, and we want information to be current. And the balance of those three things is really the secret sauce of search. Because if you're looking for how do I refinish my dining room table, you care a lot about relevance. You want exactly the right varnish for exactly the kind of wood you've got. You may not care about how recent it is, if whether it was last week or last year, it doesn't really matter to you. And you may not care that much about how authoritative the source is, whether it's a hobbyist website or a leading newspaper. But if you're doing a query for what's happening in Washington, D.C. today, you care a lot about recency, you care a lot about authoritativeness, and relevance might not be quite as important. So the balance of those different factors is really behind the hundreds of different elements of the algorithm that go into ordering your search results. And now we're seeing a change, actually, with the advent of AI. We're seeing longer and longer queries. Instead of people putting in a word or two, they're actually asking full sentences, which, because they know or they're learning that the AI tools can actually search across a variety of websites and come in with a consolidated answer for them. So you're seeing people finding information, looking for information and finding information in new ways. Now, we still feel a deep sense of responsibility to get that right. Another thing people may not recognize about Google is that roughly 7% of the queries we get every day are healthcare queries. So we don't want a hallucinated answer to what's the right dosage of Tylenol for a six-month-old, or I'm having a heart attack, what should I do? And so we are being very thoughtful about how we introduce some of these new functionalities into the tool. And at the same time, realizing that we're changing out the engine on the airplane while we're in flight. The just continuing to maintain high quality search is a huge effort. People may also not recognize that roughly 15% of the queries we see every day are queries we've never seen before. The world is constantly coming up with new questions, new issues that people want to find out more about. So we need to make sure we're discharging that responsibility while also helping people migrate into this new AI era.
That's interesting. I want to come back to AI and how it's affecting our world and how it's affecting your business. But let me ask you this. You're president of global affairs. I'm assuming that a big part of that, therefore, is dealing with regulators worldwide. And obviously, different nations have different standards, different cultural attitudes. Some are free speech, some are not. How do you deal nation by nation in this regulatory environment where somebody in Russia or China could access you just as easily, presumably, as someone right here in the New York City area?
It's a core issue that we wrestle with every day. Our North Star is our mission statement, which is Google's goal is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. So there's a built-in bias toward access to information, free expression around the world. And we push back on that. A number of countries around the world have challenged that in different ways because we're available in pretty much every country in the world with a couple of exceptions. And so we have to progress that notion, that commitment to, as is embodied in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, access to information, free expression is a human right. But at the same time, there may be legitimate kinds of content that countries don't want to have available, child sexual abuse material, for example, which is fairly universally prohibited. So we are navigating that case by case, issue by issue. We were one of the first companies to put out a transparency report to disclose the kinds of demands we're getting from governments and how we're responding to those. And that's by giving that level of transparency, it's the old line, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure people are aware when their governments are asking us or telling us not to make certain information available. Because again, we want Google search to be a map of everything that's on the internet so that researchers can find out more, human rights activists can find out more, et cetera. And we have to do that country by country, case by case.
So given my own security background, I have to ask, where do you, I know this is difficult, where do you draw the line in terms of security, in terms of what people can access, what people see, what people can put on your platform? Where does that line exist, at least in Western standards anyway?
We spend a lot of time working on, even starting foundationally on the cybersecurity level, we are probably the most attacked websites in the world, and we think we keep more people safe than any other company in the world when they're using the Chrome browser, when they're using Gmail, all those kinds of things. So making sure that we have that foundational level of cybersecurity is extraordinarily important. Then you have on top of that the content question of, are people looking for or being attacked with malware, et cetera. So we'll put up warnings if you're going to a site that has malware on it, et cetera. There are a very narrow set of situations where we wouldn't allow people to get access to information. So for example, Google search is meant to be a map of everything on the internet, including potentially problematic content, because we feel in general that it's better to have everybody being able to see what's out there. And if there is an issue with a particular kind of content, that's an issue about going to the website owner who's making that content available. But there have been challenging situations, like in Google Maps, for example. If we're mapping everything that's out there, that could, in theory, include the position of troops or active war situations, where there are very real-world consequences to providing that level of information.
And or again, a classified installation someplace.
No, exactly right. So in general, if the information is generally available on the internet, it's going to be available in Google Maps. There have been a very small number of cases where there's active hostilities and there's a clear and present danger to troops who might be in harm's way, where we have agreed to blur a certain area or blur a certain installation to avoid risks of harm. But again, we do that with our partners who are gathering information and in negotiation with relevant governments.
So coming back to AI, there were two things you said that I found very interesting. One, 7% of inquiries are health related. And two, more people go on the platform and are asking specific questions, a sentence with a question mark at the end, like what percentage of the Earth's surface is covered by water? And you get, in response to the targeted question, a targeted answer now, presumably thanks to AI. And when I hear that, I think about what is lost in the inquiry. If I went on Google and simply said, tell me about the world's oceans, I may learn a lot more about oceanography than I wanted to know, but I found it informative. But if I ask the targeted question, I mean, you and I are both lawyers. We did electronic research in the 1980s and 90s, where you could ask a specific question and you get a specific answer. Like, when does the statute of limitations begin to run in South Dakota? But in the days when you had to look through the books, you may learn 10 other things. So what do you think might be lost when a member of the public is allowed to ask a targeted question on your platform?
It's a deep question itself. And I think my answer is that you're right that you may be getting a more specific answer in Google search, although we are at great pains to provide additional links out to other resources. We do want to continue to drive traffic to publishers across the web. So if people are looking for more detail, looking for a deeper understanding, we do feature those follow-on links. But stepping back, I would say traditional Google search is just one of the ways people are using AI to search for information. Mm-hmm. We are now increasingly seeing tools like Deep Research and our Gemini tool, which allows you to look at dozens, scores of different websites and have those summarized and create a 25-page research paper for you on that range of different issues. So it's sort of broadening that you're talking about. Another tool that we've introduced in the last year is something called Notebook LM, where you can upload sources and use those to have a conversation. It will create a podcast for you. It will create a summary. It will allow you to interrogate the sources and say, this article said this, but that article said this. How do you reconcile those different things? So it's almost like having a tutor in any subject you would like to have. So the tools people have for expanding the way they're finding out about the world are mm-hmm. much deeper than they were in our day when we were doing a narrow, Westlaw or Lexis search on a particular area that happened to hit a particular keyword. Now it's much more how to explore the notion of oceans and oceanography and marine mammals and wildlife. And so all of a sudden you can organize the world's information in dramatically new ways. It's sort of like Google search is one way of presenting information. YouTube is another way of presenting video information. It's like a video library. Maps is another way of thinking about information, just organized geographically. Mm-hmm. And now AI is a way, it's like the infinite filing cabinet where you can sort alphabetically, but you can also sort by everything that is blue, or you can sort by everything that's of interest to a six-year-old, or you can sort by everything that might be related to a given topic. So this is a new way that people are encountering the world of information. And it's exciting, And it's, you know, there are challenges, there are risks of deep fakes, there are risks of disinformation, there are risks of the models not doing exactly what we want them to do. We spend a lot of time and effort with red teaming to try and make sure we're doing all this in a responsible way. We talk about being both bold and responsible. Mm-hmm. But I think it's never been a better time, if you're a curious person in the world, to find out about interesting things.
So it sounds like, from what you're saying, that the question I tend to ask is, with AI, are we making life easier for the 16-year-old student, or are we encouraging that 16-year-old student to exercise certain brain muscles that they haven't before? It sounds like you would say the latter.
I would say it is both, and we have to be thoughtful about it. Right? It's important. I like to remember Socrates reacted to the notion of writing by saying that it will be the death of memory, that people will no longer remember the oral traditions of the Greeks. And some of that is true, and that muscle memory may not be as important, but then you get the ability of the written word to be disseminated to a lot more people. And every new communication technology has some of that. Is it better to read a book on paper or to look at it on a Kindle? Does the advent of movies mean that we don't have, you know, live performances in quite the same way?
Right.
On balance, I would say that the future of education is really a rich one, because every student basically around the world is now going to have a customized tutor who can interact with them on any way they want it. So you can teach algebra. If you've got a kid who's interested in basketball, you can use basketball as a metaphor for explaining algebra to them. You can set up these models so that they are not just giving answers, but having a colloquy, a back and forth with the student to say, well, you didn't quite understand the concept. Here's another way of explaining it. So it will change the way we evaluate students. You know, the old notion of sending someone home and having them write an essay. Increasingly, you're going to see students, you're already seeing students using some of these tools to write essays. But if we do it right, it unlocks a really deeper, richer form of education. Mm-hmm. So it's a fraught time, but it's an exciting time.
It sounds like this is the thing about AI that most excites the workforce at Google, that it's opening up a whole new way of thinking and learning and expanding people's horizons. Is that fair to say?
Let me add one thing to that, because we are absolutely excited about that. And it gets back to our core mission statement. But I would also say there's a whole nother frontier here. And Google is probably the geekiest, the nerdiest of the tech companies. We probably have more computer scientists, computer engineers per capita than anyone else. There's something like 12,000 PhDs working for the company in a whole variety of different areas. And one of the things that really fires them up is the way we're looking at advancing the frontiers of science. Because AI is not just a scientific breakthrough. It's a breakthrough in how we make scientific breakthroughs. So that opens up new frontiers in things like personalized medicine. We're going to have the first AI-generated drugs coming to clinical tests by early next year. Material science, imagine a battery that has 10 times the capacity and weighs 1/10 as much, so that you could have, you know, electric planes, for example. Energy, dissemination across the energy grid, advances in nuclear fission, quantum computing is coming fast, as well as, you know, revolutions in agriculture, in all kinds of fundamental scientific breakthroughs. That, you know, a few years ago, we were saying the progress of science was getting slower and slower. Now there's the potential for it to get faster and faster. And that has dramatic implications for raising standards of living for people around the world.
Kent, are we making ourselves superfluous? Are we making the teacher or the law firm associate superfluous in some way with AI?
I think we are making our role different. AI is this remarkable tool, but the desire of humans for new and better and different things, as so far in human history, has seemed inexhaustible. So Keynes in the 1920s, I think it was, said by the end of the 20th century, we would be working 10-hour weeks. And he was right if we had been satisfied with 1920s levels of consumption. But in fact, we discovered a desire for all kinds of new goods and services and forms of education and learning and the like. And so there's this sort of constant evolution where something like 60% of the jobs we have today didn't exist 80 years ago. So I think this is the latest chapter in that evolution. My grandfather took his shower at the end of the day, not the start of the day. He would say, unless you were working up a sweat, it wasn't work. He would think about, you know, my job or your job, you're talking to interesting people. That would be a vacation from his perspective. So this notion of how we think of work, creating new jobs, you know, UX designers, app developers, these notions didn't exist even 20 years ago. So it's a very interesting time. Now, we as a society have to manage that. We have to help people with the transition. But the good news about AI is that it is the easiest tool you can imagine to learn. There are very few tools that will teach you how to use the tool. A hammer doesn't teach you how to hit a nail the right way, but AI will actually tell you how to ask better AI prompts. It also helps the least skilled people the most. It helps everybody a little bit, but the beginners really get up to average very quickly. So it's much more accessible in that sense. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, obviously many of the AI functions we've been talking about are more white collar kind of roles, as at a time when we're worried in our society about, you know, divisions and a growing income gap. To some degree, this helps empower the people who are not in traditional white collar jobs to have better employment prospects, maybe higher wages.
Do they understand the AI capabilities, and are we regulating technology companies like yours in an effective way, or are we struggling, or are policymakers struggling to keep up with the pace of development?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating last couple of years because you've seen from both sides of the aisle a real thoughtful engagement on the potential of AI. There were a bipartisan series of insight forums that the Senate held a couple of years ago. There was a report on the House side, again, bipartisan, about AI opportunities. And now you've seen the Trump administration come out with an executive order on AI. So we're optimistic that there will be a focused and aligned, a balanced approach to this. Focused because you don't want to reinvent the wheel. We already have lots of good law in the United States on fraud and discrimination and misrepresentation. You don't have to reinvent those, but you may want to have specialized laws around things like deepfakes. We want an aligned approach. I mean, there was something like 1,000 different state proposed laws in the last year alone. The more we can have alignment to avoid that kind of fragmentation, I think the better for everybody. And then I think there's a recognition that we want to be balanced and recognize not only AI risk, but AI opportunity. And, you know, to cure cancer, to make some of the scientific advances we were talking about before. And I do think there's a recognition of that, and we want to regulate with a light touch as we do it. And if we get that right, you know, the United States has a real opportunity to keep leading the world, not just at the frontier, but in the diffusion, the deployment of these tools. People forget that. There was a recent book called Technology and the Rise of Great Powers that argues that the key to technological leadership is not just inventing the thing, but leading the race to deploy. You remember, right, the United States led, you know, first invented television, first invented color printers, et cetera, but lost the race to actually manufacture them. So we want to make sure that there continues to be a spirit of optimism as we approach this. Another surprising thing to me is that the United States is one of the least optimistic countries in the world about AI, even though we're at the forefront of AI innovation. And so making sure that we continue to stay on the front foot, as, you know, we have a global race with China right now. 200,000 companies in China are using AI. Something like 600 million Chinese say they have used AI, and they're very optimistic about its potential. We need to maintain that American can-do spirit, that spirit of, you know, how do we use this to improve our standard of living, improve the work that we're doing, automate the drudgery, free people up to do more creative tasks.
Sounds like you're saying we need leadership not just to regulate us, but to challenge us as well.
And to inspire us and to sort of lift us up and look at the North Star vision of what can be. The old line from Robert Kennedy, some people ask, look at what is and ask why. I look at what has never been and ask why not. There's a little bit of that spirit. I think that, you know, finding at a time when the country is divided, the level of trust in our institutions has never been lower. Finding ways where we can work across the aisle, we can come together. The rise of AI is a tribute to American ingenuity and the fact that we have come together with this remarkable tool, a paper that Google wrote in 2017 called Attention is All You Need, which started with these very basic building blocks of, it was like the kids game we played when we were little called Mad Libs, where you'd fill in the blank. And you'd go from, you know, peanut butter and blank. It's probably jelly, might be banana, unlikely to be salami, but you can't rule it out. Right. Going from those little pieces, how do words fit together, to how do sentences fit together, and how do paragraphs and pages and chapters fit together, from those little acorns, the oak of understanding everything that's embedded in human knowledge has grown up. And that is, it's a remarkable opportunity for the United States to maintain its leadership, not just in technology, but in geopolitics, because the geopolitics rests on the productivity of your economy, the ability of your people to be able to achieve great things. So that's why it's such an exciting time to be working on the frontier and to make sure we get the nexus of technology and politics right.
Right. So last question for me. 43 years ago, when I finished law school, my graduation speaker, the civil rights leader, Andrew Young, said to all of us graduates, 25 years old in 1982, in your lifetime, you will see and do things beyond your current comprehension. And he was absolutely right. I could not have comprehended a Black president. I could not have comprehended that that person was on the Columbia campus the same time as me. I could not have comprehended being in his cabinet, leading a department that didn't exist in 1982. And I could not have comprehended the iPhone. I could not have comprehended electronic research. I could not have comprehended, certainly, artificial intelligence, though we had glimpses with the movie 2001 and the movie Failsafe. I don't know if you remember Failsafe.
Sure.
Given the arc that we're on, the pace that we're on in your space, the work that your folks are doing now, can you envision what the world's going to look like in 43 years?
No, and honestly, I don't think anybody can, but that's what makes it so exciting. You remember probably when we were in high school or before, Alan Toffler wrote a book called Future Shock. And as of 1970, you know, the world was going faster and faster. And I think it's even more the case now. The challenge, and I'll draw on a lesson that my son learned when he was studying history, he heard from one professor about something called the aperture of now. And the aperture of now is when you look back at history, you say, oh, well, this led to this, led to this. It's all very clear. And then someone asks you, well, what's going to happen in the next few years? You say, well, I can't possibly tell. It's contingent. And I think the insight for historians and for all of us is that we want to bring a certain narrative. We impose our narratives on the past. When in reality, the future is deeply unpredictable. And as that same history professor said, the problem with being a historian is you don't get to see how it ends.
Right.
And I think that's a little bit, we're in the middle of the river, but the river is flowing, you know, quickly, and it's carrying us to really new and exciting places. And you know, important to remember, for all the challenges we've had over the last couple of decades, people around the world have gotten living standards have gotten dramatically better. More than 1 billion people have come out of extreme poverty. That is unprecedented in the history of mankind. And if we can maintain that, if we can, you know, right now there are more people on Earth who have access to a smartphone than have access to decent sanitation. If we can use these tools to create clean water, better agriculture, lift up living standards for everybody in the United States and around the world, that's a historic achievement. And if technology can play a role in doing that, that's the ultimate, you know, fulfillment of the dream we'd have.
Ken Walker, President of Global Affairs and Chief Legal Officer of Google, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you very much for your time, sir.
Jay, congratulations on the success of your program. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you.